Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week the Green Party's nominee for President of the United States, Jill Stein. Jill, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be with you.
It is an honor to have you on the program. How many states will your name be on the ballot this November 6th?
The main thing is that we'll be on the ballot for 85% of voters. It's 38 states, but it's all the big states and most of the medium states, and there are a few small ones where we're not on, but the bottom line is 85% of people have the ability to go to the polls and not just pull the lever for four more years of Wall Street rule, but to actually stand up for the future we deserve.
And in the other 12 states, you can write in the name Jill Stein, correct?
That's right. In just about all of them, there are one or two where you can't, but in practically all of them, you can write it in.
And so how many people, how theoretically this could be done, right? How many people are able to vote and not even planning to vote at all?
Right now, voters are sort of split. There are 90 million eligible voters who are not going to vote because they know that neither Obama nor Romney represent them. There are 45 million that are expected to vote for Obama, and about the same number, 45 million, expected to vote for Romney, some small differences between them. But, you know, that means the vast plurality, if not majority, of voters are voting with their feet to say no to the politics of war, empire, and, you know, economic predation, Wall Street rule at home and abroad. Most voters are saying no to that and are clamoring for what our campaign is offering. The solutions that we're advancing are the very things that the American public is calling for in poll after poll. Consider only that there are 36 million students and recent graduates who are basically indentured servants with the very unforgiving and burdensome loan situation, the debt, and the high rate of unemployment and underemployment, some 50% for students. So if word got out among those students who are very well positioned to get word out, you know, we could see a sudden firestorm of a voter revolt and turn politics on its head in this country, like happened not so very long ago in Tunisia and in Tahrir Square. We can do it here, too.
There are actually, rather small, I believe, but there are actually activist campaigns being organized to vote for nobody, to send a message by voting for nobody. Clearly, a more coherent message might be sent, I would think, by voting for somebody. So let's look in the time we have at what one would be voting for by casting a vote for Jill Stein rather than for Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or any of the other candidates. One of the areas that I look at most frequently, which is of course ignored in the so-called debate between Obama and Romney, is military spending and the possibility of reducing it dramatically. What is your position, Jill Stein?
Absolutely. We're spending $1 trillion a year now on a bloated military industrial security complex. This is twice what we were spending on the military only 10, 11 years ago. We have certainly not bought ourselves twice the security. If anything, we are less secure to look at the blowback going on now across the Middle East, where Pakistanis, for example, 75% actually identify Americans as the number one enemy, not terrorist organizations or Taliban or Al-Qaeda. It's Americans who are dropping bombs on weddings and funerals. And as we've seen with the demonstrations against the American embassies and the recent killing of the Libyan ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Libya, you know, we are not in good standing these days. And for example, to look at the Afghanistan war, where supposedly the NATO forces, the allied forces, are supposed to be turning this war effort over to Afghani soldiers, but the Afghani soldiers are shooting and killing the American and NATO soldiers. This is such an indictment of this policy of brute force and wars for oil as the basis for international policy. We're saying time to cut the military spending back to year 2000 levels, which will cut it about 50%. That could bring up to $500 billion every year back into our economy to create the true security that we need here, creating jobs, a green economy, healthcare, housing, education that we urgently need for true security going forward.
Wow. So there's a stark difference right there, $500 billion a year to be put to good use as compared to something in the negative if military spending is increased, or $500 billion spread over 10 years as the dire, impossibly huge cuts that the other pair of candidates warn us about. and what would you do with drones and drone wars, and the idea of humanitarian war and small scale war in general? Would you continue these policies in any way?
You know, this whole concept of a humanitarian or small scale war, it just doesn't pass the laugh test, if this was something you could laugh about, because the civilian casualties have been so high, though it's hard to see from the official U.S. statistics, where any male of military age in a area of unrest and terrorist activity, so-called terrorist activity, any male killed there is by definition a terrorist. But in fact, studies show that it's only 2% of drone deaths that are actually high-ranking identified members of Al-Qaeda or allied organizations. So it's no surprise that this very, very cruel, very brutal form of warfare with such high civilian casualties and war crimes associated with it, it's no surprise that it has created the incredible animosity towards Americans. This is not only not effective, this is extremely counterproductive. The drone wars need to be ended immediately, and the United States ought to be leading an international convention against the use of drones in warfare, any military uses of drones, in fact, because this basically creates a whole new arms race, which is very dangerous and will come back to haunt us here on our own shores. In fact, already has, as drones are increasingly used to spy on civilians here in the United States. So very important to stop this technology from spreading further.
Earlier this month, Jill, some American peace activists were part of a delegation to Pakistan, where they met with drone victims, the existence of whom our government denies, and met also with victims of U.S. torture in Afghanistan, in the Bagram prison in Afghanistan, just within the past few years, within the time of the Obama administration. And so we have an administration that's not ended torture, that has in fact publicly instructed the Justice Department not to prosecute the crime of torture at the CIA. And another candidate in Mitt Romney, who supposedly would bring back the torture as if it were gone. But neither of them, of course, speaking to or being asked in the debates about the prospect of prosecuting war crimes, even by Americans. What is your position on this mode that the Obama administration is in of looking forward and not backward?
Well, you know, I think you've sort of pointed to it. They're looking forward, and yet as they look forward, they continue to sanction torture and to admit to torture. So, you know, it's very important to look backwards so that we can look forward with, you know, with a morality and with a humanity. We need to be a nation of laws and a world of international law. And that means upholding our civil liberties at home as well as upholding human rights abroad. And that means no torture. And as members of the military are quick to say, for the United States to engage in torture is to put our own military personnel at grave risk for the same thing. So this needs to be stopped. And, you know, that means abiding by international law, going backwards and going forward. And it does mean holding people accountable.
There's another so-called war that I don't expect to hear mentioned in any of the debates run by the Republican Democratic Party debate commission, and that is the drug war. Do you have a position on that that varies from Obama and Romney's?
Absolutely. We call for ending this failed and racist drug war that has doubled the size of American prisons, made us virtually world leader in the largest proportion of people who are imprisoned, more than China. And we have doubled the size of our prisons by incarcerating largely nonviolent recreational users of a harmless substance that is marijuana. It's marijuana users in particular that have filled our jails, and nonviolent users of other drugs. Where people have drug abuse and dependence problems, they should be treated as public health problems, not as as criminal acts. Because to treat it as a criminal act is to, for one thing, it's not warranted. These are private and recreational uses, particularly of marijuana. To treat it as a criminal act is to simply deny people their livelihood, their means of attaining housing, education, jobs, you name it. This really is very destructive. It does not rehabilitate people. It locks people into helplessness and poverty, in which they have nowhere to turn except a continuing lives of crime. So it's extremely counterproductive in terms of improving social conditions, improving drug abuse itself. And it's a terrible use of our taxpayer dollars, paying $40,000 to $50,000 a year to essentially destroy a life when that same money could be used for rehabilitation and is enough, in fact, to put any inmate through college and provide them a good education and a good job and the means of escaping poverty and hopelessness, which is the driver of drug abuse and dependence to start with. So we have a much better solution here, and we would start with legalizing marijuana, cannabis, as well as hemp, you know, cleaning out the jails of the enormous numbers of people, some 2+ million people incarcerated now at any one given time. And we can clean out our jails, stop the privatization of these jails, and enable people, you know, put those resources to good work. In fact, we can tax and regulate marijuana as a legalized substance, and, you know, ensure that our tax dollars are being wisely spent, not wasted on harmful and counterproductive incarceration.
We're speaking with Jill Stein, who is the Green Party nominee for President of the United States and a doctor as well. And we're talking about shifting expenses and priorities from militarism and incarceration and drug wars to things like college and education. It seems to me, Jill, that a huge question in the budget debate, such as it's called, is the question of whether the super wealthy and the corporate in this country will pay a higher share of taxes than they're currently paying. What is your proposal for taxation?
Yeah, in the debate, it was really hard to follow. They were so down in the weeds, and Romney was sort of creating new policy on the fly, it seemed, promising that he wasn't going to cut taxes for the wealthy. His plan that's been estimated to cut like $5 trillion in taxes for the wealthy, he was saying, oh, no, that's not true. I'll be closing loopholes. But, of course, these are unspecified. So he was completely vague, and I don't know what Obama was saying about taxes. They were, you know, extremely down in the weeds, hard to follow. By design, it appears, you know, as if the goal were to get people to just tune out, feel hopeless and useless, and deactivate people.
It works.
But in fact, you know, there are clear solutions that are begging to be implemented, because over the past many decades, across all categories of taxes, all major categories, taxes for the wealthy have been slashed down from 91% actually income tax, the higher bracket of income tax for the very rich under Eisenhower, down to, 35% maximum rate now on the income tax. And Romney's talking about cutting that further. They are both talking about cutting corporate taxes from 35% currently down to 25% in the case of Romney, almost that much down to 28% in the case of Obama. But the point is, you know, they are continuing this problem with few exceptions that are not really going to make a big difference. They're mostly continuing this very devastating trend that has allowed more and more money and wealth to accumulate in the hands of the very few, with the top 1% now owning 40% of American wealth, and the lower income 50%, that is half of the American population, the poor half, poorest half, poorer half of the American population, has 1% of wealth to distribute among it. So things have become extraordinarily unfair. The economy is stuck as a consequence. It's very important that tax fairness be restored. Very simply put, we are calling for a more progressive income tax so that the upper bracket is more in the range of 40-45%, up from where it is now, and potentially higher with the higher income brackets, so that it's a many-tiered, truly progressive income tax. We're calling for taxing capital gains as income, because why should billionaires and multimillionaires be paying at half the rate of their janitors and their secretaries who are struggling to make ends meet? Why should they be taxed more than those who are rolling in dough? So we're calling for taxing capital gains, not at its current rate of 15%, but equivalent to the upper income level of the income tax. So it would be 35% currently, or higher if the rate were to go higher. And finally, we're calling for a Robin Hood tax. Or to put it in other terms, it's a sales tax for Wall Street. Why should Wall Street be the one sector of the economy that doesn't pay a sales tax? In just about every state, I think all states, we pay sales tax, and it can be anywhere from 3%, 5%, 8%. Wall Street pays nothing. Simply to ask Wall Street to pay a half of a percent on the purchase and sale of bonds and stocks would generate over approximately $350 billion a year that would pay, for example, higher education 10 times over, to make public higher education free, could be paid for 10 times over by implementing a Wall Street transaction tax. So that would be very good places to start.
With military spending cut back and prison spending cut back and these super wealthy and the corporate and the financial traders taxed more appropriately, what's the money for? Because in the corporate debates, the whole question is framed around how will you solve the deficit crisis that is the the chief enemy of all things good in the world. And so I wonder, is the goal here to pay off the deficit, or to pay for something else, or some combination?
Well, you know, the nice thing is that if the economy starts working for everyday people, the deficit will pay off itself. And in fact, the deficit came roaring in when Wall Street crashed the economy, that's when the deficit really went ballistic. It was creeping its way up with wars, you know, with two wars that weren't paid for, and with the Bush tax cuts. But when Wall Street crashed the economy and revenues stopped coming in because there were no, you know, people weren't making the income to pay the tax revenues, that basically traced back to the abuse of the economy by Wall Street. So the fix is the things that we talked about, which will bring revenue back, but the whole purpose of all of this is to create an economy that's working for people. And that means we want to be creating jobs that put people back to work, that put an end to this crisis of unemployment. We see unemployment numbers creeping down little by little, but not very much if you look at the whole picture. We still have 24, 25 million people who are unemployed and underemployed who desperately need work and full-time work at good living wages. So we're calling for a Green New Deal to put people back to work at the same time that we jumpstart the green economy for the long haul. And that green economy basically means putting an end to the climate crisis, and also making wars for oil obsolete. So it's a very nice package because it allows us to cut that military, which is very busy spending our tax dollars right now procuring oil resources. We no longer need it under a green economy, which frees up that money, in fact, to jumpstart and create that green transition. So we're calling for national funding like occurred during the New Deal, which actually got us out of the Depression. It actually worked. It created millions and millions of jobs, unlike this voodoo trickle-down economics practiced by both Democrats and Republicans alike, who keep talking about more deregulation, more tax breaks for the so-called job creators. This is why Obama's calling for a big cut in corporate taxes so that they can do this trickle-down thing, which hasn't worked for decades. It's only getting us in more and more trouble. So by actually creating the jobs that we need and using our tax dollars to create those jobs, we can create an economy that's working for everyone with jobs in the green economy, including clean renewable energy, local organic food production, public transportation, clean manufacturing, the typical green things. And we're also calling for jobs in the social areas of the economy that meet our social needs. So childcare, after school, let's hire back those hundreds of thousands of teachers that have been laid off as a part of this economic crisis and austerity. Let's hire back the social workers, the violence prevention, drug abuse prevention, and affordable housing construction, and convert these millions of abandoned and vacant homes, into affordable housing that people urgently need. Families by the millions, are homeless in this country. We have more vacant homes than we have homeless families. We can fix all of this with a Green New Deal that puts the dollars directly into creating jobs, as opposed to the stimulus packages that have been enacted and proposed by the President and Congress, which basically create a lot of tax breaks. They have created some jobs, but not enough to really make a dent in the problem. So the Green New Deal would use these savings to actually put people back to work at the same time that we green the economy on an emergency basis, because climate change is a devastating emergency. And the added benefit is that we would then make wars for oil obsolete, and we would also create the basis for health in our communities. If we have a healthy, local, fresh food system, as opposed to this Frankenfood, this highly processed, calorie-dense, nutrient-poor food system, which is a big driver of the obesity and the diabetes and the other chronic diseases that are bankrupting us. If we had that healthy food system, a public transportation system, as well as the pollution prevention, which we get through the green energy, Right now, we're spending $2 trillion, in fact, more than $2 trillion every year on the sick care system. We call it a health care system. It's really a sick care system, and it mostly maintains people in a state of chronic disease. 75% of those sick care dollars are actually spent treating chronic illnesses that could be prevented at a tiny fraction of the cost. So actually, by moving to the Green New Deal, we create that system of health protection, a true healthcare system, which in turn can offload so many of those costs to our healthcare system, which are, you know, making us bankrupt without getting us better.
What reforms do you think would be useful in our elections in the coming years, in that you haven't been able to get on every ballot despite tremendous effort? You've been locked out of the debates. You've been locked out of the corporate media coverage. We don't have verifiable election machines in our elections. What reforms do you think are needed to open up our elections so that people can not just have candidates like you, but be informed about them?
Well, you know, a couple of quick ones I can rattle off. Getting money out of politics, creating public financing of our campaigns, opening up the airwaves so that the public airwaves are actually available for use by public candidates, so that there's a level playing field, and that will take the wind out of the sails of big money in politics overnight, and the president can basically move that not by waiting for Congress to pass a bill, but simply by instructing the Federal Communications Commission to start opening up the public airwaves for use by the public. We're calling for a constitutional amendment ensuring the right to vote so that voter ID laws cannot threaten our rights to vote. We're calling for same-day voter registration. We're calling for reliable voting technology in the form of hand-marked paper ballots so that our votes can't be stolen through electronic machines. And we're calling for voting systems that actually give our votes meaning. That means instant runoff voting that lets you rank your choices so you don't have to worry about splitting the vote, as well as proportional representation that ensures that every vote is going to count and that it's not simply a winner-take-all system. By bringing courage into the voting booth, we can markedly change this system and unleash the power of democracy. There are 90 million voters right now, one out of every two voters who's not voting because they know that Obama and Romney don't represent them. For us to get the word out to them and the 36 million students who are just waiting to find a way out of being indentured servants, which is what the future looks like right now if you're a student holding debt and you're facing a 50% unemployment and underemployment rate. So for us to stand up like the young people did in Tahrir Square and in Tunisia, we have the potential to turn this voting, this election, this political system on its head. If we win the White House, we can turn it into a greenhouse and the world will be a better place for it. But even short of winning the office, we can win the day by showing that we are no longer going to be silenced by the politics of fear. We'll replace the politics of fear with the politics of courage and stand up in the streets for what we need and in the voting booth so that we can actually drive these solutions forward to the peaceful, just, green future that we deserve.
Jill Stein, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
It's great to be with you, David. Thanks so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.